You load 16 tons, and what do you get? You get another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Yes, Labor Day was established by President Grover Cleveland in July of 1894, a week before he sent federal troops to put down the Pullman strike.
That's Professor Peter Ratcliffe, co-director of the Eastside Freedom Library in St. Paul, Minnesota, explaining the history and significance of Labor Day on the Union Yes Iowa podcast.
And it's one of the largest labor massacres in U.S. history, and that's why it's so interesting and so puzzling that it's not part of the national public memory.
Anthropologist Paul Shackle remembers the Latimer Massacre, which happened 127 years ago on September 10th, 1897.
His reflective suit, hard hat on, and steel-toed boots. But that's not what makes me feel bad. It's the big fat letters on his government badge.
From the Library of Congress's brand new America Works podcast, Greg Vogt, the singing gold mine worker from Elko, Nevada. Plus, Pete Seeger will help us remember Ella Mae Wiggins, the 29-year-old textile mill striker, songwriter, and mother of nine from Gastonia, North Carolina, who was killed on September 14, 1929, by vigilantes.
It is for our little children that seem to us so dear, but for us nor them dear workers, the bosses do not care.
And on this week's Labor History in Two, Rick Smith tells us about the making of a national treasure.
The park was very important to the labor movement. That was not why it was known as Union Square.
I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. I hope you enjoy the show.
And a fist of steel, if the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons, and what do you get? You get another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
What's Labor Day without parades and picnics? Peter Ratcliffe answers that question on the latest Union Yes Iowa podcast from the Iowa Federation of Labor. Ratcliffe is co-director of the Eastside Freedom Library in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Like everything that we're experiencing now, life is full of contradictions. And Labor Day is a holiday full of contradictions. In its origins, Labor Day was established by President Grover Cleveland in July of 1894, a week before he sent federal troops to put down the Pullman strike and the strike of supporting railroad workers and neighbors in Chicago and Pullman, which was a suburb of Chicago. So on the one hand, finally, a holiday that recognized labor, and on the other hand, at the very same time, sending troops to put down a strike. Created in a period of the 1880s and 1890s, probably, you know, of the greatest labor conflict, certainly of the 19th century, and hard to measure against perhaps the later 1930s. In 1886, workers had begun a strike in Chicago for the eight-hour day that spread throughout the United States. And in the aftermath of that strike and the repression and violence in Chicago, what became called the Haymarket Square Riot, workers and the labor movement in the United States and workers in the labor movement around the world decreed that May 1st should be Labor Day. And so what workers were often doing between 1886 and 1894 was celebrating May 1st as Labor Day. And that was a holiday that Grover Cleveland, who was a Democrat, and the Democrats in the Senate and Congress, who were so-called friends of labor, wanted to have a more acceptable, calmer, not so radical holiday. And so they picked up on what some of the building trades unions had been proposing of a holiday in September. So another contradiction. Should Labor Day be May 1st or should Labor Day be in September? So all these contradictions around it. And I think that those of us who have been around for a while know that you have to go into the contradictions, not run away from them. And you have to try to push them in a direction that's positive. So one of the contradictions that we're living in the midst of right now is this adjective essential, that there are essential workers, nurses, personal care assistants, other hospital workers, meatpacking workers, grocery store workers, Amazon workers. And so workers who were once invisible are now being called essential. But when they're called essential, does that mean that they get guaranteed safe working conditions? Seemingly not. Does it mean they get guaranteed higher pay? Seemingly not. So there are workers, I think transit workers in New York, who came out and said, we feel more like we're sacrificial than essential. They're asking us to die. I think of our friend Ann Feeney's great song about Workers' Memorial Day. We just came here to work. We didn't come here to die. So the contradictions around being essential, the contradictions around Labor Day, that we have to be willing to engage contradictions if we're going to promote social change. And I think, ironically, Labor Day is not simply then a day to celebrate labor. Labor Day is a day to generate critical thinking about the contradictions within which we're living.
You know, Mary Harris Jones was a top organizer, and her words still inspire me today. And if she took a look at our working conditions, well, I think I know what she would say. If you're talking about a worker's Memorial Day, mourn the dead while they're ringing the bell. But just remember Mother Jones when it comes to the living. We gotta fight like hell. And while you're up there talking in an air-conditioned office on a telephone that's most approved, go on and tell me how much you've been spending on safety. Pardon me, I'm not rude. I'm not saying that you don't care. I'm not saying that you don't try. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
Ann Feeney singing We Just Come to Work Here. Before Ann, we heard Professor Peter Ratliff, co-director of the Eastside Freedom Library in St. Paul, Minnesota. Union Yes Iowa is a brand new podcast from the Iowa Federation of Labor, and it's part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. You'll find links to 70 labor radio shows and podcasts at laborradionetwork.org.
Hello, everyone. We're here with another segment of Cool Things in the Media Archives. I'm the archive specialist, Alan Weirdak, here with the labor archivist, Ben Blake. And we are joined by professor and department chair of anthropology, Paul Shackle. Paul has just put out a book on the Latimer Massacre titled Remembering Latimer.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about what happened at Latimer and why is that important?
Latimer is the culmination of a lot of labor strife in northeastern Pennsylvania. There's a lot of new immigrants coming in from southern and eastern Europe, and there's a lot of anti-immigration sentiment in the traditional population. So the state legislators are trying to pass laws, and they're asking Congress to think about immigration laws. And the state of Pennsylvania legislators twice asked the U.S. Congress to pass these anti-immigration laws. They don't. So the state of Pennsylvania passed this act called the Campbell Act, which is a tax on all unnaturalized workers. And this is supported by the UMWA to support the traditional white English-speaking population. And once the workers see that they're being taxed 3 cents a day and they're not making much money as it is because it's the end of this recession and they're making $1.50 a day, right? And they're working 2 days a week, maybe 3 days a week. And then all of a sudden they see this tax on top of all this other money being taken out of their paycheck, like the dynamite and their food and other equipment that they need. They go on strike and they start closing down all the mines in the region. And their strategy was to close down all the mines related to one company. If they could close down all the mines, they wouldn't have production and they wouldn't have any income and perhaps they would have some clout. So the events at Latimer were about closing the last mine that was operated and owned by the Pardee family. The march started on September 10th around noon, and the march went all the ways to Latimer, which was several hours of marching, and by all recollection, and it was a warm day, and they get just outside of Latimer, and they're met by the sheriff and his posse. There's a posse of 86 men. There's probably coal and iron police that are joining the front, and they line up parallel to the road and also protecting the coal breaker. And that was the goal, was to march to the coal breaker and shut the coal breaker down and shut the mines down. And the sheriff comes out to meet the miners at the road, and the posse are still lined up. And he says, halt, you can't go there, disperse, you can't march. And the miners say, this is a public road, we have a right to be here. And there's an argument, and there's a scuffle, and there's a lot of different accounts that's recorded in the newspapers, but somebody yells fire, and they start firing into these men, and these men are unarmed, and several drop at that moment, and others start running away, and as they're running away, the posse starts shooting into the crowd, and they're shooting these men in their backs. 19 men die that day at Latimer, and a total of 25 die related to gun wounds. And the majority of the gun wounds are from shots taken from the back as they were running away. And it's one of the largest labor massacres in U.S. history, and that's why it's so interesting and so puzzling that it's not part of the national public memory, you know?
Well, thank you so much for taking the time out to talk with us. Remembering Latimer, a work that intersects labor, immigration, and this conflict between labor and capital. So thank you.
It's been great.
Yeah. This has been another segment of Cool Things in the Media Archives. I'm the archive specialist, Alan Weirdak, here with the labor archivist, Ben Blake, and Dr. Paul Shagel. Till next time.
On September 14th, 1929, Ella Mae Wiggins, a 29-year-old textile mill striker, songwriter, and mother of nine from Gastonia, North Carolina, was killed when local vigilantes, thugs, and a sheriff's deputy forced the pickup truck in which she was riding off the road and began shooting. Here's Pete Seeger singing Ella Mae Wiggins' song, A Mill Mother's Lament.
We leave our homes in the morning, we kiss our children goodbye. While we slave for the bosses, our children scream and cry. And when we draw our money, our grocery bills to pay, not a cent to spend for clothing, not a cent to lay away. And on that very evening, our little son will say, I need some shoes, mother, And so does Sister May. How it grieves the heart of a mother, you everyone must know. But we can't buy for our children, our wages are too low. It is for our little children that seem to us so dear. But for us nor them, dear workers, the bosses do not care. But understand, all workers, our union they do fear. Let's stand together, workers, and have a union here.
America Works is a brand new podcast series from the Library of Congress, featuring the voices of contemporary workers from throughout the United States, talking about their lives, their workplaces, and their on-the-job experiences. Drawn from hundreds of longer oral history interviews collected by field workers for the American Folklife Center's Occupational Folklife Project, America Works is a testament to the wisdom, wit, knowledge, and dedication of today's working Americans. These engaging oral histories, which are preserved in the American Folklife Center's archive, are enriching and expanding America's historical record.
From the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
Welcome to America Works, excerpts from interviews with contemporary workers throughout the United States, collected by the Library's American Folklife Center as part of its Occupational Folklife Project. This America Works podcast features gold mine worker Greg Vaught, one of several contemporary gold miners interviewed about their jobs in Elko, Nevada, by Western Folklife Center folklorists Charlie Seaman and Meg Glazer, working in collaboration with the Nevada Gold Mining Association. Mr. Vaught talks about his past jobs, how he came to work at a gold mine, and how, in his present job, he oversees mine safety. A multi-talented man, Vaught discovered that his safety instructions were sometimes more effective if he incorporated them into song lyrics. So he did, which earned him the honorary title Newmont Mining's Safety Troubadour.
I wound up at Newmont because I wound up in Nevada. I came out here like a lot of people did 150 years ago in search of a better life, right? So I thought I'd give mining a try because that's what people do around here.
So when you went to work at Newmont, what was your first job there?
I worked in the assay lab. The fire assay is the main thing. That's pretty interesting. And one of the main things I really enjoyed there was atomic absorption, when you like shoot a beam of light at a certain frequency into the solution and it gets all those little particles in the atom excited and they shoot off photons and stuff.
Oh, that's very cool.
It's very interesting and reads the gold content in solution. And there's also bond index where you test the hardness of the ore and how much energy it will take to break it down.
Tell me about when you first started your first day of work there.
At the beginning, I was on rotating shifts and I had to do night shifts, and that was rough. Doing 12-hour shifts in the middle of the night, back in some room crushing and screaming rocks all night. And these young fellas that I was working with, they said, "You know, I just don't know if that Greg's going to make it here or not."
What about your coworkers, people from all over the world, it sounds like, come here to work?
This is true. My boss is from India. We have people from Peru and Australia and Canada, Mexico, because we have mines all over the world and we can learn from each other. We had a person cross-training with us here in the geology department last week who was from New Zealand. So it's a diverse group, and I think there's strength in that. I worked in a lab, and I started learning about different parts of the mine. And I thought I need to get out there and see what's going on and get more experience. And I had an opportunity to go underground with the engineering department and learn about ventilation.
Do you like being underground?
it's all right. There are some guys that would rather be underground than be on the surface. Yeah. I don't know that I'm one of those guys, but it is a different world down there, and it's very interesting. I think it gets in your blood. I appreciate the guys that do it because there's a lot of people that wouldn't, and we need them to do that. Underground, there are some issues that people in the office don't face because you can have things like ground failures, gases building up, you know, a fire starts up, and then all of a sudden the gases can become an issue very quickly. There can be gases that emanate out of the rocks and the ore, you know. Mm-hmm. So one of the most dangerous industries, I don't know. I'm sure it's up there. But we've done a lot over the years to improve the systems. That is, trying to engineer out, you know, ways that people can get hurt. Mm-hmm. What we still struggle with is human behavior.
Always.
Yeah. Right. And so our company, and I think a lot of other companies too, are starting to switch their focus because we've worked really hard over the years on engineering solutions to, you know, how can we keep people from getting hurt. Now we're switching a little bit to how can we influence people's attitudes and how can we influence the culture.
With song.
Yeah, that's a good segue right there. That's kind of where I was at a couple of years ago when I said, you know what? We got to do better. And that's when I started writing songs about safety. It's been, I think, 2.5 or 3 years I started writing them. I had this idea, and then I went to my boss, who was a metallurgist, and I said, well, what do you think about me writing songs about safety and doing them for our group? And he looked at me like I was nuts, you know. It's like, you do know you're in the mining industry, right? But I just figured, so what if I embarrass myself or whatever? You know, if we don't do something different, people are going to keep getting hurt. If we're going to do better, then we have to think outside the box. Well, one of the first ones I wrote was called the IMSHA Blues. And for people that don't know about mining, IMSHA stands for Mine Safety and Health Administration, the government body that regulates the mining industry in safety. People kind of dread it when they come around. And I throw in humor because I know that humor helps disarm people. Because when you start talking about people's behavior, they get defensive, right? Not only that, I know that it helps you remember stuff. So I tell people, I say, you know what, if you like my songs, that's great. But if you remember them, that's the point. Here he comes in his reflective suit, hard hat on and steel-toed boots. But that's not what makes me feel bad. It's the big fat letters on his government badge. Time to duck and cover, gonna take my break. He won't come back until he goes away. Makes me feel nervous and he makes me sweat. I shouldn't have to work in this kind of stress. I feel like there's a witch hunt on. I can't wait till the inspector is gone. I just know he's coming for me. Citations fill the air like confetti, yeah.
That's great.
You know, I didn't want to do anything halfway. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm already treading into dangerous territory here. I'm already expecting to be made fun of. So I just like, you know what? If I'm going to do this, I need to do it as best I can. What's funny is I got a chance to do that song for the former head of IMSHA. And the whole time I was doing that song, I was just thinking, I wonder what this guy's thinking about this song right now. But I got the chance to meet him afterwards, and he said, no, that's an appropriate message. Because of my safety music, I found myself getting to know people all over the company, and that's opened some doors for me. I'm just thankful for the opportunities I've had to get creative in the mining industry. Never thought I'd do music in the mining industry, but you know, I see myself being in Umon a very long time. I just want to help improve the culture in my company and anywhere else people will listen to me.
Listening to goldmine worker Greg Vaught, interviewed by folklorist Charlie Seaman at the Western Folklife Center in Elko, Nevada. To hear the complete interview with Mr. Vaught, as well as interviews with more contemporary goldmine workers, please visit us online at www.loc.gov/folklife. On behalf of the American Folklife Center, this is folklorist Nancy Gross. Thank you for listening to America Works.
This has been a presentation of the Library of Congress. Visit us at loc.gov.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1997. That was the day that Union Square in New York City was named a National Historic Landmark. Republican Governor George Pataki explained the importance of the park in a press release. It is only fitting that the National Park Service should recognize Union Square Park's long history as a focal point for political expression. New York is proud that the first Labor Day parade took place here in Union Square Park more than 100 years ago, establishing a tradition that spread across the nation. Although the park was very important to the labor movement, that was not why it was known as Union Square. The park got its name because it was the place of intersection or union of two busy New York roads, what are today Broadway and Fourth Avenue. In 1831, the open space at the intersection was declared a public space. The space became an important location for labor rallies and political demonstrations. In 1882, the first Labor Day parade in U.S. history marched through the square, 10,000 workers waving their banners high. In 1911, union workers again gathered at Union Square to protest after the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire killed 146, mostly young women and girls, some garment workers as young as 11 and 14 years old. In the later 1920s, the park was demolished for construction of the New York subway, but the space continued to be important to the city's union movement. In 2002, a series of 22 bronze plaques were dedicated at the park to tell the history of Union Square. One of those plaques tells of the first Labor Day parade. Another is a collage of images of labor demonstrations and sheet music of labor songs. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You load 16 tons, and what do you get? You get another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. Yes, sir, there's a menu, a Kentucky coal miner that pert near owes his soul to the company store. He gets so far in debt to the coal company he's working for that he goes on sometimes for years without being paid one red cent in real honest-to-goodness money. But he can always go to the company store and draw flickers or scrip. You know, that's little brass coins that you can't spend nowhere only at the company store. So they add that against his account, and every day he gets a little farther in debt. That sounds pretty bad, but even that's got a brighter side to it.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app, and even better, if you like what you hear, please like it in your podcast app and pass it along to others. You can be part of Labor History Today by reading a labor history item. Just shoot us a note, laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. Today's music is 16 Tons by coal miner's son Merle Travis. Some 75,000 coal miners in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia ended a 10-week strike on September 11, 1897, after winning an 8-hour day, semi-monthly pay, and the abolition of overpriced company-owned stores where they had been forced to shop. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices, broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org where there are links to 70 labor radio and podcast shows. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.
And what do you get? You get another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.